Then the next point I want to make here is that the inclusions I'm going to talk about, these protein aggregates, really all the evidence is that they are being targeted for degradation. And I'll show you evidence that they're ubiquitinated and they're really, it seems like the cell would like to get rid of them. So there's a kind of a paradox here about marking a protein for degradation. But then, in the case of these pathologies, which show up late in life, actually not going on to degrade it. How does that happen? And we'll maybe talk a little bit about that. The last three topics will be that the machinery, you're already familiar with a lot of the machinery involved in protein degradation, of course, ubiquitination and movement of proteins to the proteasome. But it's becoming increasingly clear that also part of this machinery are chaperones, that the cell has to make a decision. Does it want to somehow try to refold the protein correctly, or does it want to then send it down to some pathway and just get rid of it? And that is a, must be a very important decision point for a cell. And this is probably and this is only speculative, I have no single molecule data here, but this is probably a single molecule decision. It has to be decided for every single protein. But then there's some sort of ensemble decision that happens in a cell that where these protein inclusions may get to a point, and now the cell must sense that it is its survival is somehow sufficiently compromised, and it has to make a decision to undergo apoptosis. So those are the main points I want to make. I'm going to make one very, very speculative point at the end, which is not my idea at all. It comes from Susan Lindquist, that when we're talking about mechanisms that involve this kind of machinery, chaperones, that are changing levels of chaperones, one of the things that happens when chaperone levels decrease is that different phenotypes, almost unpredictable phenotypes, start to emerge. And I'll just mention that very, very briefly at the end. So let me now move into the body of the talk and respond in more detail to your question about what are inclusions. Inclusions are seen in a very wide number of neurodegenerative diseases. So in Parkinson's disease, the inclusions are called Lewy bodies. We know what the protein is. It's the name of the protein is called alpha-synuclein. It's a protein that normally is associated with vesicles on neurons, synaptic vesicles. In another disease called frontotemporal dementia, the inclusions are made up of the tau protein. In this case, it's a protein that is on the microtubules, on the axonal microtubules. In amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or Lou Gehrig's disease, the inclusions are often made of an enzyme called superoxide dismutase. And in a whole interesting category of diseases that are known as polyglutamine repeats, because they extend these CAG repeats and make these long chains of glutamic acids, and there are many examples of these diseases. The most famous are Huntington's and spinocerebellar ataxia. These diseases expand these CAG repeats in front of a gene, and that gene product then becomes the inclusion. So in the case of Huntington's, the protein has been named Huntington, and spinocerebellar ataxia, it's ataxin. These got these names because these were previously unknown proteins until they were discovered, unknown genes until they were discovered in these disease entities. So the and all of these inclusions are occurring intracellularly. But that's not the only way this happens. They can also occur extracellularly. So in Alzheimer's disease, not only do you get the tau-forming tangles, which you get not just in frontotemporal dementia, but also in Alzheimer's, but Alzheimer's disease also accumulates this peptide called A-beta. Prion disease has extracellular and now inclusions would not be the right word. These are extracellular deposits called prion proteins And another entity we don't have to talk about much has another type of deposit called Notch 3. But the point of showing you this list is that there's no obvious way that we can say all of these proteins are in one category. Perhaps the ones that form extracellular deposits tend to be more membrane proteins, plasma membrane proteins. And that is the case for the precursor to the A-beta. The prion protein is a membrane protein, and so is Notch 3. The ones I showed you previously were all intracellular. But beyond that, some are cytoskeletal. You saw an enzyme there. It's really hard to say why a protein may be predestined during aging to go down this path. So tau is very, that's a good point. Most of them are fairly abundant proteins, yes. Yeah. But I don't know how to actually weigh that to put numbers on that. So I'm going to talk about that right now. So that's, so tau is, so splicing is part of the story here with tau, and that's my next point. But before I get to that, let me just show you, maybe you haven't seen these things so much, what they actually look like. This is a neuron from the human brain. You can recognize it. It's a pyramidal cell. It has this triangular shape. And if you can see the whole thing, that pointed tip would really go way up toward the ceiling. That's the apical dendrite, and that's the cell body. And that brown, nasty thing is the Lewy body that's made of synuclein in Parkinson's disease. These are the amyloid that deposits extracellularly in Alzheimer's disease. And these are the tau protein. Again, you recognize them already. The pyramidal cells here, these triangular shapes, with the tau protein forming the fibrillar inclusions. So this is what they look like. And now if you do electron microscopy on them, most of these inclusions tend to be fibrillar. I hope you can see this here. This is a negatively stained electron micrograph, which is why it's white. And then there's an antibody that's attached to gold particles, the black dots, that's labeling it. The antibody is a tau antibody, and the white, if you look really closely, forms these paired helical filaments that is the way the tau filaments tend to form. That's right. So tau assembles into these filamentous structures, and there must be an early step of disassociation from microtubules. And I'm glad you asked that, because under normal conditions, here are microtubules, and these side arms are where the tau would be. So now I want to make the point about how it's really small changes in the production of these, in the generation of these proteins that seem to be able to lead to the pathology. Even small changes in the normal protein. A protein that doesn't necessarily carry a mutation. So here's the way we think that that A-beta, that small fragment leading to the plaques, is generated. There's an enzyme complex that's called presenilin. It sits in the membrane, that's those barrels, and the precursor to the A-beta is this protein that's sticking in the middle of it. The presenilin cleaves it, and this all happens normally, and releases, it cuts in half, releases one part of it, the extracellular part, and this part goes intracellular. And it's right here that the A-beta forms. There's a cut that happens out here, and this enzyme cuts right there. So there's two cuts that generate the A-beta peptide. A mutation in presenilin can lead to a very small increase in the amount of A-beta that's produced normally and results in the disease. An increase of normally, we all make a small amount of A-beta. If you measure in the blood, it's in the picomolar amounts. If you measure it in a patient that has one of these mutations, it may be tenfold increased. So this is one suggestion, and we can talk about this in more detail, but it's one suggestion how very small amounts of increased generation of these proteins that have the tendency to aggregate will lead to disease. Now I want to show you the same concept with tau and splicing that you had raised. Pardon me? I'm sorry.
You said it was temporal, but now you said that sounds good, and I said you said it was small amount.
Yeah, small, right, small amount. So, okay, let me now go on and try to provide some evidence for the same concept here, small increases leading to late life pathology for the story with tau. Here are all the different splice isoforms of tau, what you're looking at here, if you concentrate just on these black bars, are a structure in tau that binds to the microtubules. It's in some splice isoforms, there are three of them, and in other splice isoforms, there are four of them. And this alternative splicing decision goes on in all mature neurons, such that we all make about 50% of the three repeat form and about 50% of the four repeat form in cells.
So how many of the disease genes are directly?
This is probably the only one. That's the only one where there's a splicing problem leading to the disease. The other ones have other types of problems. But in every case, whatever the problem is, and I'm going to then summarize what these problems are, the bottom line is always the same. A small increase in the amount of protein that's being generated results in a deposit in the cell. So, this is the normal splicing, and there are some mutations in tau that occur, and some of them are, let me just go back one second, this alternatively spliced region right here in which an additional repeat is inserted in the gene, this is referred to as exon 10, so exon 10 is alternatively spliced. And here now we're looking at the consensus splicing sequence around exon 10. And if one then looks at where a number of mutations have been found that lead to neurofibrillary tangles and a disease called frontotemporal dementia, they pretty much track right along this stem loop structure adjacent to the exon 10 adjacent to exon 10, right in the region where the U1 SNRP will bind. And the effect of every single one of these mutations, and actually this slide is a little outdated because now almost every single one has been found in different families. Every single one of these mutations, the same thing. They all change the ratio of the three repeat to the four repeat tau that's generated, again, by a relatively small amount. And again, by a small amount, this time we normally have about 50-50 of the two isoforms. It may shift it to 60-40, and always in favor of four repeat. Okay. So I've shown you a couple examples where mutations, one at a splice site, one in an enzyme that generates A-beta, lead to small increases in a protein that then is going to end up being deposited much later in life. Of course, these mutations I showed you are carried from birth, and the pathology is going to be showing up four, five, 6 decades later. So this small imbalance is happening in a small percentage of people that carry these mutations. But as you know, most of the people with these disease entities do not have mutations. Genetic forms of Alzheimer's and some of the other entities I'm referring to are actually very rare. Most people that have these neurodegenerative disorders don't have a mutation. So we again ask, why? Why are they getting the disease? And maybe the answer is somehow related, again, to small increases in the amount of the protein that's destined to be deposited. So this is, I've taken this from a review written by John Hardy in Human Molecular Genetics, and quoted him here. The haplotype of the Mendelian pathogenic locus influences the disease risk for a sporadic disease. That's what we're talking about now. Sporadic forms of these diseases. Why do you get them if you don't have a mutation? In the absence of coding changes, a haplotypic association implies, and indeed there are, there is for all of these diseases, or most of them, there is evidence that the gene locus that encodes the protein that's going to be deposited often has a haplotypic association with the disease. A haplotypic association implies there is genetic variability either in the amount of expression of the protein or in the alternative splicing of the protein, and this contributes to the disease risk. So the idea here is that in people that have sporadic diseases, the sporadic forms of these diseases, what we really want to concentrate on, perhaps, is how the protein that's being deposited, how that gene is being regulated to either look for polymorphisms in its promoter region, or looking for differences in how transcription factors that may bind that promoter region may act selectively on a promoter for one of these genes and not other promoters. And the evidence for this concept, again, and I've sort of touched on this already, but just to mention this again from now another perspective, I'm going to again mention these three entities. I mentioned Parkinson's disease. The protein that's deposited is alpha-synuclein. Well, there's been a rare form of Parkinson's disease that's inherited in which the alpha-synuclein gene was found to have undergone a triplication. Another example here in Alzheimer's disease, in which the precursor for that protein, A-beta, is the amyloid precursor protein. I think most people are probably aware that individuals that have trisomy 21, Down syndrome, again, have three copies of the chromosome, of chromosome 21, and 21 is where this gene is encoded. There are individuals that have partial trisomies, and I should say actually that it's very well established that everyone with Down syndrome, as they age, will end up developing the phenotype, the pathologic phenotype of Alzheimer's. They get plaques and tangles in the brain. It's a 100% risk for Alzheimer's disease. So what they would do, there's different ways of doing that. One very common way this is done is by what's called SIBPAIR analysis. So you might take lots of families and take one SIB that has the disease and the other that doesn't, and then go through extensive sequencing, perhaps around one of the loci for these Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, they're taking a blood sample. And then there's different ways this is done. What's often done is they spin down the blood, get the white cells, and extract DNA. So, So that's been discussed a lot, and very, very hard to know that for sure. It's something that's still debated, but there's so far no one has been able to really get really substantial evidence for that idea. Well, you don't want to biopsy a brain in a living person, but you can do a post-mortem, and people have done that kind of work, and it's been a muddy area that has not really been very revealing, is the bottom line. Have been found in different families, that's right. Is that supposed to be what to you? Well, I don't know if it's strange. It's real. Well, so what's the comparison group? Because see, this is the people that carry those mutations are more likely to show up to see their doctor, whereas the people that may have mutations that are silent somewhere else out in the intron between exon 10 and exon 11, we'll never know. However, indeed, there has been a lot of sequencing through that region, and we know polymorphism rates within that intron, and they tend to be higher than a mutation that for any one of these sites. These kinds of mutations, the word that's been used for these kinds of mutations are called private mutations, meaning that they occur in just one family. And so that while their incidence of any one of these mutations is extraordinarily low compared to a base change somewhere else in an intron. These would not be called polymorphisms. Polymorphisms have to occur in a certain percentage of the population. Okay. So now, I've tried to, did I finish this slide? Yeah, I wanted to build an argument here that, increased amounts for various reasons, making increased amounts of the protein that's going to be deposited for any number of different reasons is what is likely to lead to the disease when there's a mutation. But what we know less about, but what is an important area for discovery, is whether or not the more common forms of this disease, when people get the disease sporadically, whether they have some dysregulation of these particular genes. That's the question, the open question. Okay, so now to move a little bit more into sort of the body of the talk. I'm showing you again a picture of human brain. This is from an Alzheimer patient, and the Alzheimer patients, as I mentioned, also get these tau inclusions. These look for all the world like tau inclusions here in the pyramidal cells, but the antibody here is not tau. This time the antibody is ubiquitin. So in the case of tau inclusions, and in fact, in the case of every intracellular inclusion, it has been the case that ubiquitin is covalently bound to the protein that forms in the inclusion. Well, yeah, so the protein in the coding region is mutation free. You could do that, I think. Again, that's very, very hard to check the level of a protein in a single cell. I think that would be very, very difficult to do. But I think your point actually raises another interesting question, which I wasn't going to talk about, but I'll just mention it very briefly here, which has to do with the topography of these diseases. Why one cell is healthy and its neighboring cell, it's the same cell type, two pyramidal cells next to each other, one gets the problem and one doesn't. For all of these diseases, there's this rather exquisite topography. So in the case of Parkinson's disease, it's the substantia nigra that gets attacked. Even though synuclein is in many cells in the brain, one area gets involved. In ALS, as you know, in Lou Gehrig's disease, the anterior horn cells of the spinal cord that get attacked. Even though superoxide dismutase and other genes involved in ALS are present in all cells in the brain. So there's this extraordinary topography at this very gross level. At the individual cell level, there's also a lot of difference, and there it's very hard to even describe different differential vulnerabilities. In Huntington's disease, which attacks a region of the basal ganglia, part of a region of the brain deep in the brain involved in movements, the small stellate neurons are affected, and larger neurons in that same region of the brain don't have the problem. It's not that anyone has really minimal. That's a good question. Certainly, they predominate in postmitotic cells, but I cannot answer if they never. Well, there is. Now I'm really going back to like many, many years, but I think there is an entity. There's a thing called Mallory bodies in the liver if people drink too much, and that I think is in a still dividing cell. So I'm not sure. It's also an interesting question because we had this talk here about mitosis is serving as a. Remember yesterday someone gave a talk about mitosis as a filter, a bandpass filter, a low filter, and I was thinking that that's a nice role for mitosis to clean out this noise, and if this problem exclusively affects postmitotic cells, that would be interesting. But I'm not sure that's absolutely true. So so here's the crystal structure of ubiquitin. Which we'll talk about for a few moments. I don't think I really have to introduce ubiquitin here, but I'll just say a word or two. 76 amino acids, very highly conserved. Between yeast and humans, there's only been 3 amino acid changes. And this is what marks a protein for degradation when multiple ubiquitins bind, at least 4. And to get ubiquitin binding, there's what's been called a ubiquitin pathway. It's a series of enzymes. Enzyme 1, of which there's only one gene encoding in E1, that activates the ubiquitin. And E2, which then is considered a conjugating enzyme that has to be used in coordination with the E3, the ligase, that recognizes the substrate to which ubiquitin is going to be bound. So, the reason it's drawn like this is because we have one E1 gene, we have multiple, but not many. I think it's more than 3, but there are a relatively small number of these conjugating enzymes, and the diversity in this system really comes at the level of the E3s. There's a lot of different E3s. They're what's involved, in, as I say, in taking the ubiquitin and recognizing a specific substrate. Here are the substrates. And when they do that, the fate of the protein is to move to the proteasome where it's going to be degraded. So now I'll spend a few moments now telling you about a few experiments that we did that maybe shed a little bit of light on this whole issue. Began this project just to asking a very, very simple question. The question was, what is the E3 ligase that recognizes ubiquitinates tau? It wasn't known. The experiment started out by simply extracting tau protein from control brains and Alzheimer brains, and then doing in vitro ubiquitination, which is a pretty straightforward procedure. And we noticed right away that the tau that had been extracted from the Alzheimer brain was very readily ubiquitinated, but the control brain tau was not. Something was going on with the Alzheimer tau that was being recognized by this in vitro system. And so the first thing we wanted to do was to now put into this artificial system various E2 enzymes, and to sort out the, while we were ultimately wanting to know the E3, along the way we first wanted to find out which is the E2 enzyme. And you can buy them all, recombinant forms of all of these E2 conjugating enzymes, and going through them, the UBC H5B was able to reproduce the in vitro ubiquitination. It was an interesting one, because UBC H5 is a particular E2 that seems to go up as part of a stress response in cells. Now, it's known that there's a lot of different ways that E3s recognize their substrate proteins. But the one that we were particularly interested in, just because of our knowledge of tau, was this idea about that phosphorylation may serve as a recognition site. The reason we were interested in that is because, in particular, the tau in Alzheimer's disease is very heavily phosphorylated, more than normal. And there's many examples where it's phosphorylation that will be the determinant for whether an E3 recognizes a substrate protein. And we asked, how about tau? So, and this slide just shows you the multiple phosphorylation sites that are all through this protein. It's thought that the function of this phosphorylation, there's about 20 different phosphorylation sites here that are involved in very fine regulation of tau binding to microtubules, and a number of different kinases. It's not just one kinase that does this, it's about four or five different kinases and very independent signaling pathways that all feed in to this target. So here was our next experiment. We again isolated tau protein and treated it with various enzymes that would remove different post-translational modifications. Sugar groups here, tyrosine phosphatase, and here protein phosphatase 2A, and removing this particular enzyme that removed serine or threonine phosphates now interfered with the in vitro ubiquitination. So we had a clue that indeed it was the phosphate that was being recognized. So that led to our next experiment, and here the experiment was to take recombinant tau now, bacterially synthesized tau, to artificially now phosphorylate it with using an enzyme that will put phosphates on the very sites that protein phosphate 2A can remove. We know what they are. And and then to bind this to a nickel column, take a brain homogenate and run it through the column. And now, whatever binds here is probably going to have a lot of the machinery for ubiquitination, because tau has now got the phosphates on it, and we think that we might be able to capture the E3 ligase this way. Yes? What is a homogenate? A homogenate is a brain tissue that's been put into a blender and homogenized. That's the kind of things we do. Smoothie, yeah. So, okay. So now, because we know that the E2 enzyme is UBC H5, to try to further hone in and to make our results a little more likely to be credible, what we then eluted, what bound to the phosphorylated tau, and ran that through the UBC H5B column. So now, and then eluted that, and on the stuff that came off, we performed mass spectroscopy. Here's the result. Most of what was alluded, this is, the lettering is a little misaligned here, but you can see here's the lane where most of the proteins eluted, and by putting them into the mass spec, we were able to identify the bands. And you can see here that the two of these three are heat shock proteins, and one of them is heat shock cognate 70, and the other is one of the small heat shock proteins, again, as mentioned by Cynthia Kenyon as well, heat shock protein 27. So, but at least by mass spec, the technique looks like it wasn't quite sensitive enough to find an E3 ligase. It's still there. In fact, I'll show you evidence that it is. But this information gave us a big clue. Because once we saw that HSC70, heat shock cognate protein 70, was now bound to this form of tau, that gave us another bit of information. It's known that when heat shock, when certain heat shock proteins bind, such as HSP70, HSC70, or HSP90, bind to a protein, they then recruit a known E3 ligase called CHIP to drive the substrate to the proteasome. And so that said, we should look for CHIP here. And CHIP just stands for the carboxy terminus of a protein that binds to HSC70. So, and here's the kind of information by which we know that. That, as you know, HSC70 combined to ATP and undergoes this kind of a cycle where the whether it's bound to ADP or ATP affects the favorability for folding the protein to which it binds. And here we know that CHIP will bind to HSC70 from other data. It's well established. So, that was my point. I forget in the overview. So now, on that first overview, I'm down to like number three or four, because this is I don't have an answer for that, but this is the nugget of the problem right here, because now, the binding of the heat shock protein looks like it would like to get tau back on track. And does it fail to do that, or does it now just give up and now CHIP binds? Yeah, I don't have a clue. So now, knowing that that CHIP should be present here, we did a number of experiments. I won't go through all the details, doing in vitro experiments and looking in these fractions, Western blotting, and using recombinant MYC CHIP. Bottom line is that CHIP is also associated with this complex. So at this point, before I talk about this picture, this must be a very important node, decision node for a cell. Again, just to reiterate what was just raised here, that somehow there's this vulnerable point where tau gets phosphorylated. It is probably in some vulnerable state in a cell. It becomes recognized by a heat shock protein to perhaps keep it folded in the right way. And if that fails, or if something goes wrong, or if perhaps too much is made, then that becomes a signal for additional binding by CHIP and targeting to the proteasome. Now, from the overview, the next question that came after that was not just the decision about the individual protein to get refolded or to get degraded, but the next question was, after this seems to go on iteratively for a while, the cell itself, I guess, I would assume, encounters some jeopardy. And has to start deciding whether or not it wants to continue living. So we we tried to sort out a little bit about what the role for Chip may be in this whole process. And this is now, we're now back in a rather artificial system. This is just, this is not a neural cell. We're expressing all of these proteins. We're expressing Chip and Tau. We're expressing the enzyme that phosphorylates Tau and ubiquitin in a what's called a Cas cell, another type of cell entirely. So any answer is just a guess, but my guess would be that under normal conditions you need this four repeat form of Tau phosphorylated, that we have it and it does something normally, but it's one of the more dangerous guys in the cell. And dangerous means that if we increased another splice isoform of Tau by a little bit, then the cell doesn't really get into so much jeopardy. But this one may be, I'm just speculating, may be present at levels that are close to some threshold that can push the cell into pathology more easily than perhaps other splice isoforms of Tau. And what the idea of what happens at that threshold is that now it becomes recognized by heat shock protein. So the trigger for that recognition could be misfolding. Yes, yeah, heat shock proteins can come off again if they manage to refold. Then Chip will be recruited. That's. Yeah. So again, I guess that was raised here. That's one way in which it works. That it's just the kinetic thing, and if it's there for too much time, it says, okay, now we need Chip. It's not working. I'm sorry, I don't quite get your question. Right. Right. This four repeat form, right? I would say that would be one reasonable hypothesis. You know, I can imagine that would the molecular behavior, the crowding in the cell, somehow change at certain concentrations, and now you induce dimers, oligomers. This one probably does. This one is it's been very difficult to get real structural data on this. It probably does, but a lot of the others do. Yes. Yeah. Sasha. A lot of questions buried in there. The Tau is particularly interesting because it's in contrast to many other proteins, it has very, very little even secondary structure. It's a very elongated protein, and its molecular weight is not so much. It's 36,000 molecular weight, but it's actual size extends very long. You saw those arms on the microtubules coming off the microtubules. It can really extend a long time because it does not have even very much secondary structure. And the way the individual carbons are moving within tau is very rapidly. It's got a lot of motility within it. Yeah. Yeah. So you can give rodents this disease by making transgenic animals by putting in human mutant genes. Their tau has the splice isoforms. The ratios are a tiny bit different, but not by much. Maybe that's all you need. I don't. We have no evidence that even primates will develop naturally, even when they age, tangle pathology. That's not been looked at. It could be that there's a difference in the phosphorylation sites. That would be interesting. But just to follow up, I should say that this, in contrast, primates and dogs and many creatures get the amyloid pathology. So this issue of conservation of these aggregates with aging is different for each one of them. Okay. So here, now we're up to what happens to a cell when it encounters cell that just grown in the laboratory, a non-neural cell, when we're artificially manipulating all of these components. And so here in lane 5, you can see this is just a cell that's not been transfected with anything. And it's given a value of, after a certain amount of time, of we would call it survival 100%. And if you put in tau and a form of the kinase that you put in the tau and the kinase alone, you haven't this has not changed very much. But what is really I think here is the sort of the take home message is if you compare these two lanes, because here in lane 3, if you have tau is getting phosphorylated because you have the kinase here, but there's no chip, so tau is not getting, presumably, it's not getting moving into the ubiquitin system. And in lane 3, without the chip, the cells have now begun to apoptose. But if you simply now take the same mixture but add in chip, you rescue the cells to a certain amount. The difference is statistically significant. So the idea here is that this is to address the question, and it's a question in the field, that is that when people see these inclusions in the cell, the first impression is that they're bad, and they probably are bad, but are they bad in the sense that they are directly killing the cell? And evidence like this, and evidence from other labs too, in totally different systems, is leading to the conclusion that the cell is attempting to protect itself by forming these inclusions. By binding to chip and ubiquitinating these inclusions, you actually improve cell survival. So that would imply that there's something some state of the protein before CHIP binds and before ubiquitin binds that is really the dangerous form of the protein. Okay, good question. So that's what the next slide will try to answer that. And this is answered in two ways, one biochemically, and the next I'm going to show you immunocytochemically. On the top you see all these different combinations of this stuff. But really pay attention really here where we have everything here. We have CHIP now, and what you're seeing along here is tau, but only when you have all the components do you actually form ubiquitinated tau. Ubiquitin binds as a tree. Many ubiquitins bind in several places, and that's why you get these multiple higher molecular weight forms. So the presence of all this stuff is doing the right thing. And now to get to your question, what we also did here is notice that the cells are actually analyzed in two fractions. One is they're treated with detergents, and one is looking at a detergent-soluble fraction and one insoluble. So one characteristic of these aggregates is they tend to be insoluble in detergents. So this would suggest that indeed the CHIP is not driving these to the proteasome and getting them degraded. It's putting them into some detergent-insoluble state. And that is further supported here by the immunocytochemistry, where, again, when you do these various combinations, here's a control state where tau is just binding. The green is looking at tau because it's bound to GFP, and it looks like it's just a nice microtubule pattern. But when you put in CHIP and the kinase, you form these aggregates. This is now being labeled with a tau antibody. The anti-flag is to the ubiquitin, you can see that now we have these aggregates formed. So the answer to your question is that CHIP was not successful in driving phosphorylated tau to the proteasome. All it did was drive tau into an aggregate, and that aggregate, and here I'd be going a little bit out on a limb, that aggregate appears to be protective for the survival of the cell. CHIP serves as an E3 ligase, so it is required, so it's before it gets ubiquitinated. Yes. Not known.
Would it be possible to over-inspect it and see if that...
So if you make a transgenic mouse in which you simply overexpress wild type, if you overexpress a tau cDNA in a transgenic mouse, you get very minimal pathology. That was experiments on quite some time ago. Then when these mutations in tau were discovered, people started putting in these mutations and they started to see tangle pathology. That's right. Yes. Although I have to qualify that a little bit, but you know, just for our purposes, yes. That's never been done in the tau story. There is one of the other diseases I showed you up here was a disease called spinocerebellar ataxia that Hoda Zoghbi works on. in which a taxon deposits. And she is manipulated. She's bred animals that form a taxon with various ubiquitin mutants and can change the aggregate formation. But I want to tell you one more thing about these transgenics, because then the most recent thing that's really quite interesting was is that everybody thought that just human wild-type tau in a transgenic mouse would really not result in much pathology. And recently, somebody published a paper showing that if you knock out the tau, the endogenous tau gene in the mouse, and then put in the human gene, and now we're talking about the whole gene, the tau gene's enormous, the intron between between these alternatively spliced exons, the introns go for, something like 30 kb. Put the whole gene in, and they got remarkable pathology. It really gets back to that slide I showed early on about the haplotype. There's something, there are factors probably within that are, in the case of tau, in the intron, that may also be regulating splicing in some way. And if we're talking about other conditions, maybe in the promoter regions that are regulating levels of these gene products. It puts the ubiquitin on. So the next step does not happen, although it depends on how finely you parse those steps. Because after CHIP binds to get to the proteasome, you need another protein called BAG1. And then that protein binds to specific residues within the proteasome. So where in that sequence where there's an interruption is not known. But basically, yes, somewhere in that next step is a problem. So I'm really coming to the end here. And it's just to review a lot of what I said. Normally, tau is on microtubules. It is probably a very long-lived protein. It doesn't appear to be, under normal conditions, even a ubiquitin substrate. It's not really clear how it's turned over. It's very long-lived, so maybe there are other mechanisms of turnover. Then the tau will get phosphorylated. Normally, and phosphorylation of tau drives the kinetics of tau either on or off the microtubules. But sometimes tau will get very heavily phosphorylated. And that can happen to a small extent under normal conditions and more under pathological conditions. And that's when, and this I think is a really vulnerable junction. Because here, because it's a vulnerable moiety in the cell, it is going to be recognized by a heat shock protein. And all of this stuff here is protected. It's going to then, heat shock 70 is going to, Kage protein is going to bind to it. It's now going to get ubiquitinated and maybe move to the proteasome or maybe get sequestered as ubiquitinated tau aggregates. All of this is a protective limb. But there's something else happening here, and this is where a lot of people are converging now in the field, all of these inclusions that I showed in the first slide, that they're vulnerable, when they're most dangerous, is when they form these toxic, if you saw that whole thing, it would say toxic oligomers. And this is... I would say the cell that has inclusions there's pretty good evidence that a cell with inclusions is still functional. A cell with inclusions, cell death is the problem. You don't want to have the inclusions because it says that now this cell is getting faced with this problem, and sooner or later it may have to make some serious decision. But the inclusions in and of themselves are not so bad. They're not jeopardizing the cell. They're sort of a last-ditch way in which the cell can still try to save itself. And yes. Yes, in all these conditions, the occlusions accumulate with time. So, final, penultimate slide here is that I mentioned this, that these oligomers may form, and they may be toxic for the cell. Well, we don't have a lot of knowledge yet about tau oligomers, but a number of people, including Peter Lansbury, have been looking at these kinds of potentially toxic oligomers for A-beta and synuclein, and they're starting to find, by doing AFM, very interesting shapes, that they're these annular structures and things called protofibrils. So the idea is that there is some form that these proteins take before they get to form these big aggregates that is perhaps the pathologic entity. And the last really speculative slide I want to show is, again, this, I mentioned that I was just going to try to leave on perhaps an intellectual high note. This picture from Sue Linkless' work, I think it's very interesting that in almost all of the neurodegenerative diseases, the phenotypes for these diseases are really very variable. And I mentioned you see different topographies, you see, we don't know why one cell lives and one cell doesn't. And clinically, people behave quite differently. And what Susan Linkless showed is that if she made a fly mutant in which she reduced genetically the levels of HSP90, what emerged were all of these remarkable phenotypes that somehow hidden in the genome was the ability to make a lot of phenotypes and what was preventing that from happening was the correct folding of proteins. And what may be happening, I don't know that the binding of heat shock proteins to these inclusions is actually reducing the levels of heat shock proteins. That would be very important to know if this is going to be interesting or not. But if it is, you could imagine that there's going to be a diversity of different problems that are going to be emerging. So, acknowledgments. Almost all of the data I showed you was done by Hide Shimura in my lab. The mass spec was done by Steve Geige. Some other people that contributed. This was all done while I was at Harvard. I should know that, and I don't know the answer to that, actually. I would not be surprised if it were done, but I just somehow have just overlooked it. It really does, yeah. I don't know the answer to that. I bet it's in the literature. If I had to guess, I would question how viable they would be. But people are often surprised in knockouts. Things you think for sure are going to be lethal turn out not to be. Yeah. Right. Well, in the case of HSC and HSP70, it's a lot, although I don't have a number. Hundreds. I don't know about that. I would just be guessing if I gave it a number, but it's fine. But I can only tell you one thing. In the case of HSP90, The small ones are in the 20s. These are the small heat shock proteins, yeah. They're sort of a slightly different category. HSP90 has a predisposition to bind to signaling proteins, which is why Susan Linkless chose HSP90 to reduce in her flies. Again, it's something I should know, but I don't.
I don't know the answer to that. Do you know the forms? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's of course that's what's commonly said. You know, in the case of tau, there's not very many hydrophobic regions. It's a very unfolded protein. Yeah. So the protein that's not doing its job is tau. I mean, the protein tau is doing its job, but there's a gain of function that it's acquired. Yeah. So I should rephrase that. The gene that's not doing its job, and consequently the protein, in the specific cases where there is a mutation leading to the disease, is tau. Because mutations in tau, trivial case. In the sporadic forms of these diseases, you're right, anybody can guess. It could be trans factors binding to regulate splicing, it could be kinases, it could be phosphatases. There's no kinase that's specific to tau, but there have been two kinases that are implicated pretty strongly for this kind of phosphorylation. One is called CDK5 and the other is called GSK3 beta.
So, but it's not known that between healthy individuals and individuals with sporadic disease, the ratio of the phosphorylated versus non-phosphorylated tau is different.
That's right. That's not really known. That would be very hard to know. It would be very hard to find out the level of phosphorylated tau in a healthy individual. You have somebody who has to volunteer for a brain biopsy. Yeah, well, so there's. You could probably do it that way. It's whenever you have postmortem tissue, it really becomes more problematic. But yeah. And because it's remarkable how quickly things start to change postmortem. Yeah, you probably could do this in mice. I don't think it's been done yet, though. That's right. And some of these transgenic models will be interesting. Okay. Thank you.